FGCU students each year. And as I said, we have three awardees, winners of the scholarship this particular year. We have Joseph Osprofresca, Nicholas Froling, and Sanders Payne. Each of the students are seniors in finance. Joe is originally from Naples. He's graduating in December 2014. Nick is originally from Palm Beach Gardens, is graduating in May of 2014. Sanders, also graduating in May of 2014, is originally from Fort Lauderdale. So I think all of them are currently looking for jobs. I don't have any positions open in the next few months or a year, you can keep them in mind, as with all of our students. So you can just give them. You can go ahead and sit down. And another thing that I was asked to mention from the board is the CFA Institute has recently, I'd say probably in maybe the last 2 years-ish, begun a program called the University Recognition Program. And what that means is if the university's, essentially their finance and investment curriculum, covers at least 70% of the candidate body of knowledge for the CFA charter, then the CFAI, the Institute, recognizes the university as, well, I guess, being worthy of mention by the Institute as, you know, covering enough of the candidate body of knowledge. And so, long story short with that is, at GCU, the finance undergraduate program in the Lutker College of Business has applied for that, and I guess Wednesday before Thanksgiving, we learned that at GCU and the Lutker College of Business now has a CFA Institute recognized finance program. So that means that our program and university will be on the CFA Institute website as recognized. We get scholarships for the CFA exam that we can award to students, and we can also use this recognition as marketing materials and essentially tout our program. So just kind of wanted to note that to all of you and all of those, well, all pretty much are knowledgeable on the CFA exam and what is, you know, included in the candidate body of knowledge. So going to mention that.
All right, thank you very much, Travis. Just one more announcement before we get started. The forecast dinner is going to be January 30th. The first email went out yesterday, but it is our kind of our marquee event of the year, so we encourage everyone to come and make sure to tell your friends and colleagues. Our speaker today is John Scott with Closed End Fund Advisors. John is portfolio manager and executive vice president. He's an expert in the area of closed-end funds and has been mentioned in the USA Today. So please join me in welcoming John.
Well, good. I'm keeping an eye on the time, but a couple of things I have to start with. I'm recording the presentation, so I have it transcribed, and once it gets to our compliance, we'll both have the audio file available as well as the transcription and the slides available as a PDF. Typically, that takes about 48 compliance hours. During the presentation, if you have a question, if I haven't explained something, if I've used an acronym you don't know, please raise your hand and help me make everyone understand what you're questioning. Just for my benefit, the folks here, are they more retail-facing advisors, family offices, institutional analysts, or analysts, any people with more analyst role, trust companies? What am I missing?
Retirees.
Who's no longer getting a W-2? All right, there you go. Perfect. Helpful, usually a good mix, but I have found every society is slightly different. Who here currently owns a closed-end fund? Okay. Who here has owned closed-end funds as more than a quarter of their portfolio ever? So I'm going to give you a little bias. I really like closed-end funds. I know them really well. We use them pretty much for all of our portfolios. So some of my perspective obviously comes from there. You don't have to use them for everything. They're not perfect for everything, clearly. The goal of this presentation is to get your feet wet in the perspective of the knowledge. And is there a better spot for me to stand? Or is this spot right here good? It's good? All right. And I have more slides that we can cover in the allotted time, but I'll go through the important ones. Oh, anyone that's really excited about this topic, is there one thing that you want to make sure I cover? Anyone that just came here, well, I wish he said.
Which one I'll go up 50%?
Oh, which one? Great. Yeah. Well, if we pick a small one and all buy it, it'll go up 50%. and then it'll go down 50%. So, all right, let's dig in. Again, trying to cut the slides down this morning. One thing, if you do put your business card in, we'll enter you into, for 90 days, you'll get our news alert system. And you can then, if you win the raffle, you can choose either, as long as your people are compliance-wise okay with the offering, either 6 months of our daily, of our weekly data service, or 3 months of our best ideas list, which was literally launched last month, so it wasn't even on the sign. And you can take any of the materials that you want before you leave. So we're basically an investment management firm specializing closed-end funds. If you really want to know, you can read the bio at the end. But today's presentation is for income-oriented portfolios, so closed-end funds currently do the best work. What is the way to build it? What are the risk factors associated? What should you know to put these in either your portfolio or your client portfolios when you need to have blended income yield that's not going to get destroyed in a rising rate environment? So that's what my, in 45 minutes, if I've done that, then you all clap. All right. So a closed-end fund, conceptually, the first important piece is it's born like any other stock. It's an IPO. It doesn't have inflows and outflows. It raises $500 million or $1 billion, and then the manager goes and does his job and buys whatever the mandate was. And you have to think that permanent capital adds some benefits to its juice. So it adds that there's never a reason for the manager to sell something because people want their money back. It allows him to buy less liquid securities. And it allows him, because also the fact that closing funds can have preferred share classes and other types of leverage, he can actually lever an income-based portfolio to get yield levels that are higher than what you can get in other structures without just buying high-yielding stuff to get there. Active management, so unlike ETFs, which are 100 years younger than closed ends, there's an active management as part of the core process to a closed-ended fund, and investor liquidity. So you could have permanent capital with active management, but it's as a private fund or as a hedge fund or maybe some of the businesses y'all are involved in. And this is an investment that allows investors to trade every day on the market to get in and out at their own desire. Really, why I love closed-end funds, because I'm clearly not in the age bracket of people needing income, is they're inefficient, and I think that there's opportunity for patience and diligence to create alpha, to create better entry points and better exit points. And you, as you get to the presentation, you should learn, hopefully by end, you'll know why they're so inefficient and how you can tap into that without getting in trouble. This is more of a history slide, but the first one traded in the New York Stock Exchange in 1893, as I said, 100 years before the first ETF in 1993. They have two unique types of leverage, intraday trading, and again, most important bullet point on this entire slide, and we'll cover it more than once, is 2/3 of closed-end funds are bond funds. Half that's municipal bonds, roughly, half that's taxable bond funds. So people think, oh, bonds are boring. And whether you think rates are going up or down and bonds are good or bad, you have to remember that a closed-end fund is an equity listed on the stock exchange that just happens to derive its value from bond investments. It trades like an equity. It doesn't trade like a bond. So you need to remember that, and you'll get some data later that helps you understand that. That, yeah, a third of them are equity funds. They trade very similar to other equity-like investments. So the state of the closed-end fund union. We've been, there's 600 funds a year ago, there's 599 funds this year. Interesting, because we've had 24 new funds, but we've also had 25 mergers. Or actually, 24 mergers and one liquidation. As I said, about 2/3 bond, 1/3 equity. And if you can't read the small print, I know it's hard, about $251 billion in total AUM. That's very simple, net asset value times number of shares outstanding. If you happen to be a closed-end fund geek like us and wonder why the ICI stats are off by more than $10 billion, it's because they count preferred stock of a closed-end fund as part of its market cap, and we say that's leverage, we net it out. But a year ago, I didn't know that, so now I do. All right, so who owns closed-end funds? This is usually interesting, but they tend to be people with more money, with more income, and older because of their income focus. It lends itself to retired investors. And yet they're a little more complicated in many ways than ETFs and open-end funds and regular stock and bond portfolios. Not that those can't be complicated, but just less people understand them. There's only 2% of the population owns them. And so the knowledge flow about them just doesn't get out there as much as other securities. And if you weren't sure, closing funds print and then asset value, most of them do it daily. The rest of it almost always do it weekly, except for the few cases that they own. There's one MLP fund, which is Master Limited Partnership, that has private MLPs who only print net asset values quarterly. So guess what? They update their net asset value quarterly as well. If the market price is above NAV and net asset value, it's a premium. If it's below, it's a discount. Probably something you're familiar with completely. But if you didn't know that, the rest of the talk makes very little sense. What we found to be more important, so as I got further in my career and really trying to find ways we can do this job better, help educate people better, how to avoid this, what we thought were the simple mistakes if you lived them every day, it was people would say, oh, they still go to New York for conferences. Oh, you like closed-end funds. So you buy a discount, and then you wait for it to go away. I go, well, kind of, but there's a chance that the discount never goes away or gets worse. So you have to think twofold. What is normal for a fund in its own history, and then how applicable that to the future, and what's normal for its peer funds? And if it's dramatically different than its peers, and you don't know why, you should keep digging. Because things don't typically trade 5% cheaper than their peers, unless there's something going on, because this is not such an illiquid market that the inefficiencies are that crazy. So we like to talk about the trend. So this graph here is simply the net asset value of an emerging market bond fund, which just generally has these nice ups and downs on the chart, so I use it, versus its market price. So it's the spread between the two. It's generally driven by performance. Like generally when things aren't good, price goes below NAV. When everyone gets all excited, price goes above NAV. But this is the plot. And so you can see, while it's not a sine wave, it's not a perfectly relationship, there are times when it pops up and it pops down. And understanding that when you see this fund at a 5 premium, it doesn't guarantee it's going to fall down, but it historically has not held a 5 premium for long. So if you own it at a 5 premium, maybe it's a good time to buy something different. Either hold it into cash or swap it to maybe another type of investment or another type of closed-end fund. If you see it around a 7 to 10 discount, unless the rules are changing horribly, and this is a really good manager, so it's a well-known manager, then it's generally a good time to get in because the people have oversold it. Again, you have to want to be in the net asset value. If you have discount go from 5 back to par or 0, and an asset value keeps going down, you're not making money. You bought something relatively cheap to itself and then sold it slimmer to itself, but still lost money. You need to want to be in the guts of the portfolio. You have to want to be in the exposure you're in, like you would in any investment. But this helps you time entry and exit points based on what's normal for a fund or a peer. And you can get this chart for free at CAF Connect, which is CEF Connect, paid for by Nuveen, powered by Morningstar.
This is one of the drawbacks of
Well, that's a very good point. So it's why we say once you get it's most common in the MLP funds presently because they're trading at rather high premiums to themselves. And so when you're in a fund north of a 3-4 premium and there's a shelf offering to offer secondary shares, then you can expect a rights offering or a secondary offering because they're going to be able to do it. So that is one of the reasons to get out of the premium, because that's a risk factor that can just pop you down for no other logical reason than the dilution. Very good point.
Along with that question,
sure.
Like that Templeton fund was at 10% premium at one point. Why wouldn't somebody come in and buy half the fund and vote to shut it down?
Then you lose 10 premium?
Yeah.
Then you lose 10%. Now the discount. So most closed fund owners are retail investors. Average ownership institutionally is about 15-16%, depends on the way the year shakes out. There's protections in place from the fund level to avoid being killed, as you know, which is in the interest of corporations. And people that build quarterly or monthly on assets. If the fund themselves owns a lot of their own stock or insiders do, then they can block that activity. But that is the reason why it's hard for most closed funds to go beyond the 15 discount, because the activists really like to get in 12 to 15. And if you see a discount wider than 15 and you don't know why, or maybe 15 and a half, it usually means the activists don't think they can win, or so expensive it's not worth it, or they can't hedge out in an asset value risk. So one of the main reasons you do that is you say, oh, I'm going to close a discount, but what if it's an equity fund, what if the S&P drops 40%? So you need to hedge that risk out, or if you're a bond fund, you know. So that's some of the nuance that you'll get, but a very good question, and one that has perplexed people outside our business for years. Generally, because retail investors don't vote yes. They kind of vote with the board because it's easy. It's what the proxy statement says.
Is your experience management teams in these RIAs buying back their own funds?
Well, share buybacks is one of the funds that we own a lot of. We finally have a new manager, and we worked hard with him to get him to buy back shares because of their discount. And they started finally. And it's good because their largest shareholder was not happy, and if they hadn't, he could have decided to join the activist. So buying back shares at discounts can be very good for the closed-end fund and a very risk-free return relative to NAV. Good question. So the state of the current closed-end fund environment. A year ago, if you saw my slides from CFI Houston, I'm sure everyone studied them beforehand, the chart looked a lot different because we've had some structural changes in the forward expectations in the bond market since last November, a year ago November. Discounts for muni bond funds around 9 for the national, taxable about 8, and equity funds are slightly wider than normal. The best way to see it, though, is this is the average closed-end fund. We actually started collecting data in 08. Morningstar powered it, and then we took over the data, and unfortunately, I didn't negotiate the contract very well in 2008. Once we left them, we had to give up all of the previous data. But they're so big, because they're a $560 million business, it took them over a year to notice and remind me, and so I got to use their data for that year until we had at least, you know. So unfortunately, I can't go back before May of 12. I know what that chart looks like. If you scour the internet, you might be able to find that chart, but I cannot provide it anymore. So the closing fund discounts have slid. Now remember, two-thirds are bond funds, and if anyone here is on bonds this year, it's not been the best year for bonds, and then think about adding investor sentiment and leverage to it, it definitely has hurt performance. But that also means I think people overshoot the bottom like they do in other investments, and is why you should be looking for that break in trend. So this one breaks out. The key here is the red is U.S. equity funds. The light blue is non-U.S. equity funds. Those tend to generally be between 7.5 to 10 discounts just historically for the average group. But we saw bond funds a year ago just overpriced, which meant we traded the heck out of them. It was not a very good tax year for our clients because we felt everything was expensive, so we kept trading on relative value because we said 3 premiums are ridiculous long-term. Bond funds generally trade at 3 discounts, and a bond fund, if you're lucky, yields 6% or a little higher, and so you hate to have a risk of 1 year's distribution just in overpricing. But now we're back down to what's considered a more normal level, and it could overshoot a little bit more, but you know, that's, I have no idea what the market will do presently, because I haven't checked in for about an hour. Liquidity. So liquidity is important. So why do I think a closing fund portfolio, how can you guys go and beat the billion-dollar hedge funds? And maybe you work for the billion-dollar hedge funds. I don't know you guys well enough. How can you beat them with resources and perspective? Well, the challenge is 74% of closing funds trade between $250,000 a day and $2.5 million a day in total liquidity. That's market price times 30-day volume. So it's hard to have more than $500 million in closed-end fund exposure and trade them. Lazard built it up over time just kind of because they saw stuff they liked, and they have about $500 million just kind of for fun. There's a couple of billion-dollar groups that do more than dissident activist activity or that generally follow and do preemptive activist work. Outside of that, it's generally people that have between, on the institutional side, between $25 million and about $200 million in closed-end funds, and that's where most of the professional or institutional trading is. And then it's a ton of retail people that either were sold these by advisors and don't know what they own, or they picked them up on their own because they were searching for yield. If I talk to a college class, the number I told you sounds like a lot of money. This group probably knows, gosh, that's all. But here's the neat thing about closed-end fund liquidity. One of our trading firms, because that's how we help reduce our market impact, emailed me, and they had two-thirds of a day's trading volume on a fund that trades almost 1 million shares a day available at a price if we're willing to accept it. So this is a pocket of the capital markets where there's still phone call negotiated equity trades. Now, they're not done by everyone, and you generally have to have a reason to move that much money to make that phone call, but you can actually have, there's about five people that specialize, maybe six, in trading closed-end funds institutionally to where we use them for liquidity, other groups do, and they help. So if I like something and another person hates something, he tries to help connect us, not in the open market through not held orders, actually through fund negotiated. So there is more liquidity there than I think people see if you know to go that route. And we have two that we work with, and there's others based on what our needs are as a firm.
How much you guys run?
We run about $90 million. But we also have, we sell data, research, and consulting. So some of our biggest clients actually pay us a quarterly retainer versus a discretionary fee. Good question. Volume trends. So if you think about it, I think the liquidity issues, and then we look for where volume is trending major group-wise and fund level-wise. This is part of the core data we collect and analyze weekly in our stuff. You know, where the trends are. Not surprising, bond funds are trending higher because the tax loss season is upon us. And if you're not familiar with tax loss season and closed ends, it's been released yet. It will be released tomorrow on our blog, an article with our perspective on tax loss selling and how we prove that it's happening and how to try to capture it. So volume trends is an important sector. And then correlation, we actually look at, on a 30-day and 90-day basis, how reactive a closed-end fund's market price is to its net asset value. Because one of the questions we're constantly asking is what's going on because the sector's not doing well or doing awesome? Or are there activists going in or out? Or are there just people buying stupid discounts or stupid? I mean, what's driving it? Is it because of a trend in the market? And we look at peer group average correlation and then fund level correlation, and we look for disconnects. So some of our weekly screens are for disconnected, overly correlated, or under correlated funds based on the peer group average. And the trends, you know, this was a data point I thought of last summer, like a year ago summer, and I thought it'd be interesting, and then we started to collect it weekly, and we got a chart. And so now I can prove it, at least to me it's interesting. What this chart tells me, the orange line is taxable bond funds. We do keep the same color code through all of our charting, so it does get easier over time. It is the wildest swings in the correlation figures over time. Equity funds, the regular, more generic, boring equity funds, tend to be a little more boring in their scales. And then muni funds are almost as wild as the taxable bond funds. My takeaway for this is that when you see an inflection point in the correlation, it suggests, and we found it to suggest, that there's a turn of the over and under, like the overselling and overbuying, because suddenly the group is turning, which can't be done just by an activist, can't be done just by any one market participant. It really has to be done. You know, these funds are 100 funds or more per line. The equity funds are 50 and 81, I think. But the bond funds are over 100 funds per line, so it's hard to really get thrown off guard. So when I introduced closed-end funds, I said, remember, the bond funds are listed equities that derive their value from bonds. And one of the biggest factors we've learned from talking to advisors or to individual investors is they buy a closed-end bond fund, and they like the yield, and they're happy, and then something happens, and it drops 8%, and they panic and sell, and they cry. So what we try to encapsulate is, if you look at the standard deviation of the net asset value versus the market price for equity funds, yeah, it's generally a little bit more for the market price, but they're still close. Like it's not going to change your usual tolerance for upside or downside volatility. But you have on the bond side, and this chart we've been producing now for over a year, so it really hasn't changed dramatically. You have more than twice the volatility of the average muni and taxable bond fund than its actual guts. And that's on top of the actual closed-end fund guts being levered on average like 30% for muni funds and like 20% for taxable funds, which themselves adds volatility. So these are not the most boring investments out there. But I would argue that if the volatility stems from just inefficient, weird trading versus actual problems with the investment management company or the sector, that this really provides opportunity versus really true risk of just having a really volatile, like what I would see, you know, stock or bond. And so if you don't know that you can have this type of volatility and you buy them or build a portfolio around them and you don't plan for that, either through communication with clients or just work with your investment committee at the firm, you're probably going to have to do some explaining. And this is in a way the most boring slide, but I think the most telling if you're going to buy bond closed-end funds.
I got a question.
Thank you.
I personally pay taxable bonds.
Okay.
And I reinvest all the dividends.
Okay.
And I have not run the regression, but it seems to me that every month, the days before I'm actually going to reinvest my dividend, the price spikes.
Oh, yeah.
Does everybody front run the...
I don't understand it. We actually have a tax-sensitive strategy, and you can't be completely tax-sensitive and be in closed-end funds. So if you've got something that really abhors taxes, no. But we have a more tax-sensitive strategy that actually looks to buy after the X date because, you know, it reduces the after-tax effect. So closed-end funds, I don't know. Retail investors seem to like to, I'm going to buy the dividend and then be taxed on it. Okay, go for it. You're very correct. It's
all
a
right.
Very common...
I mean, just looking at it.
It's not just that one fund. Yeah. It's across the whole structure.
Okay. A lot of the institutional trading groups find that when you capture the dividend, they have less appreciation than the dividend they receive. And these guys probably make 12% a year just on the capture.
Just on the fact that the market price moves less on a percentage basis than the NAV when it goes S. When it goes, yes, from the dividend.
And now they receive on the dividend is less than what they lose in the capital increase in the price.
That's a common trend. It has some exceptions, but yeah, that is another common trend.
You've got to be fast, you've got to have the training system.
You do, and you got to think if you get too big, it gets harder because you got to be trading that active, you're going to really need to have some liquidity providers. We try to be within 1 or 2 cents of the VWAP, and that's how we prove success for our. As execution. But very, very good questions. And I'll stick around for about an hour after in case we go over and you have to get back to work. If anyone can stay over, I will stick around. So I just finished a friend's book on bonds, and bonds aren't forever, which is not a surprising topic. But he had a couple arguments that really opened my eyes. So the summary is that, so inflation is 3%. Let's just pretend that there's no disagreement there. But inflation... doesn't account for the same standard of living. And we generally have an accretive standard of living on an annual basis of 1% to 2%. So if you want the same today's best goods and best resources versus 5 years ago, you actually have to be beating inflation. And so if you think of inflation being 3, round this to 2, you need 5% return to match the cost of broad brush goods over time. And if you pay taxes, like many people unfortunately do, then you really need closer to 6 or 7, 6.5, 7, depends on your tax bracket and what's involved. And so I read that, finished the book on the plane yesterday, pulling this together in my brain. You know, the average closed-end fund, if you were to be half equity, one, and then a quarter muni bond and a quarter taxable bond. And I'm not saying anyone should do that, but that's a decent mix of what's available in the sector. Right now, Friday's indicator yield 7.3%. Now, the group here is smart enough to know that you can have a high dividend paying fund or any investment and have it actually do very well performance-wise. That yield is only one part of total return. And if you bought something for $10 and it paid you something later, if your total return ends up being less than $10, it was by no definition a good investment. So when we think about building a closed-end fund portfolio, for the most conservative people that can't handle volatility, that doesn't necessarily make sense. But yeah, you don't have to use all closed-end funds like we do. That's just our choice because we like them and we analyze them thoroughly. If you want to blend around 7%, this number has been as low as 6.7 the last 3 years. It really, you know, 6.7 to 7.3 is a reasonable range of what we've seen in this blended figure. So if we use a metric of you need to be around 7%, closed-end funds offer a really good picking ground for blended yield or average yield at that level. It doesn't mean you can buy anything and it gets there. And it doesn't mean there isn't risk involved, but it starts to give you the ability for the forward expected cash flows to solve that investment need. And with people with that need, whether it's for their clients or themselves, are ones that are often attracted to the sector. So let's talk about how we get there. First, by just grouping what's available. 91% of closed-end funds yield over 5% a year. Now, a few of those pay most of it in the fourth quarter as capital appreciation. They're more equity-like strategies, U.S. or non-U.S. But that starts to give you that if you're not into dividends and if you are in the highest tax bracket in a taxable account, then outside of the few sectors that are tax sensitive, probably not the fit for you. Sure.
Is your definition of dividend income?
Distribution yield. Very good point. So it's a distribution forward-looking indicated distribution yield. So, and we do have a chart later that shows you the average income-only yield of different closed-end fund groups, because that's the one that's hardest to fudge with, or that's least volatile, generally. Obviously, income can get squeezed or expand over time. That's a very good question. So this slide, I'm only going to say, is the lowest here is 5.6. So it's not like, you know, the peer group average is right in that 6.7 range with a couple of higher levels, just to prove it's there. Here's that slide I suggested. So if you only look at income only, but this is market price yield. So it's based on the board's current dividend policy, how often they pay a year, and their market price. This is the blended yield for the major sectors. And you can see that really in the last year and a half, you know, taxable bond funds have been just below 7 to just above 7. Muni bonds have been 5.5 and are now up closer to just under 6.8, I believe. And so this income-only yield, it's the harder to fudge, because return on capital we'll talk about can be complicated, and gains come and go. So people then say, well, gosh, that's a higher number than, you know, Fed funds is almost basically nothing. 10-year Treasury is not even at 3. How do you get there? Well, there's two main closed-end fund ways you get there that's actually, you know, not fudging the numbers and pushing the dividend too hard. One is the cost of leverage. The yield curve is still very, very favorable. Short-term rates are low, long-term rates are higher, but still not crazy. So we took all investment-grade blended funds, all Nuveen, because fund sponsors tend to report data consistently. I wanted to have better analysis. And Nuveen has a ton of muni bond funds. If you look at their average levered fund, and this is net asset value yield, which no one can buy, but we don't want to worry about market pressures right now. We want actually portfolio levels. The unlevered fund's about 4.3 if you blend that out. The levered fund's about 5.9. Not hard to see if you eyeball it, but it's about 1.7% extra pass-through yield because you have a levered bond fund versus an unlevered. Now, you're taking a more volatile net asset value, and you are taking a stance on where rates could go, and you need to be mindful of that. But right now, today, I don't think, you know, most people believe that rates are going to jump up tremendously in the short to medium term, though your definition of medium could be different than mine. This gives you an idea of how most of these funds get that higher yield. And I'll tell you, it's a lot harder to find unlevered closed-end funds on the bond side than levered. Like, there's only 4 Nuveen unlevered muni bond funds that are investment grade. So I only could do a comparison of 4. The other is the fact that discounts, funds are generally at discounts. Average discounts are 9 right now. So if you take net asset value yield, which again is dividend policy from the board forward-looking, and then you look at the difference between the market price, because of the way discounts are, and this is one of the deepest discounts. It's a 20 discount, because I like to have big number changes to show proof points. But you're getting 2.3% extra yield just because the market price is beat up. Now, this is a long-short commodities fund. Hasn't had a pretty 12 months. It's, we believe, under some tax selling pressure right now, and on the cusp of also being a challenging net asset value. You can't hedge it, in my opinion. I know a guy that tries. He does all right. But so discount leverage, and then actually balance sheet leverage of the fund itself helps you get that yield higher. I forgot a little animation. Cool. All right, so this one, I'm going to basically just talk in like chunks about the boxes. I'm not going to cover everything because we're not here for 2 hours. We're here for 45 minutes, and I've got, from my understanding, about 12 minutes to wrap up. Price analysis. Is it cheap to itself or its peer group? What's that historical trend? What do you project to be the future landscape for the sector or the investment? We do that based on ranges of discounts, volatility adjusted discounts, relative, which means versus itself versus its recent time average. And then we also look at the net asset value range on a 1 year basis versus market price on a 1 year basis. Got a lot more content on, but basically, is it cheap, is it expensive, and versus its peers. Yield analysis, to this gentleman's point about is this income or is this distributions, you know, what is it made up of? So looking at the income-only yield, which is the hardest to fudge, it's not foolproof. There's a couple of funds that somehow find a way to return your principal, classify as income so you pay taxes on your principal. Beautiful thing, recommend it highly. But a lot harder in the structure. It's the bad yields are much more likely through return of capital. And what we'll do is we back out leverage from net asset value yield. So if you look at the average closed-end fund, and I didn't run this week, I ran a couple weeks ago when the yield, I think, was 7.2 for the average sector. if you back out, if you do back out leverage, back out return of capital, which is generally the one that's, you know, possibly the worst, the average closed-end fund portfolio manager has to yield 5 to meet the current policies. So, some of that does come from some gains, and some funds prove gains on a consistent basis, but that brings you down to a more reasonable level. Return of capital, which is not always bad, it depends on where it's coming from and why it's there. We do classify destructive return of capital. We wrote a white paper on it. But effectively, is the manager's, the portfolio earning the net asset value yield, and then is return of capital common in the sector? And we produce a number that says X percent of the return of capital, if there is destructive if these formulas are met. And that's a number that we run. Nothing we do that I don't think you do in other securities, though I don't trade them, so I don't know. But we look at the last time, how dividends are changed, like small changes, big changes. And we look at when the board of directors is anticipated to announce the dividend next, because they it's not a foolproof way, but it gives you an idea of when the cuts might be coming, or possibly even increases, if you know when, because boards tend to be very, we do it the third week of November on Thursday every year. It's very, you know, they tend to be, this is the policy, we do it, because we'd have to change the policy to change the release date. Other stuff that's important, because there are leverage vehicles, is the cost of leverage and types of leverage. We do break that out in our review. Liquidity, we've already kind of covered the rest. Activists is very little activist work the last 9 months. The trends are starting to show that I believe there'll be some nice 13 filings in the next 3 to 4 months that might prove interesting to get involved in tenders or either dividend increases or share buybacks or funds will go from quarterly distributions to monthly. There's different ways to try to narrow the discount, and I just foresee that based on the trends that that's increasing. We wrote an article about it, so if you're interested, feel free to read it, but MLP closed-end funds, most of them have a calculated deferred tax liability that writes down that asset value. Some of that is justified, in my opinion. The full amount is generally not justified, again, in my opinion, and we like to add some of that back in, which generally brings these down usually to some sort of discount versus the premiums they see in the trade at. The key is, that may never be recognized as fact, and the discounts may never actually exist. But if you have a larger deferred tax liability, and if you only account for some of it, you're effectively buying an asset for less dollars. You might be able to buy a dollar worth of MLP assets for 95 cents. The relationship may never change, but you were inherently leveraging the portfolio without having to leverage the portfolio because of that data point. And that's something that's produced in their financials typically quarterly, and it usually grows over time. And so it's why MLP funds generally trade at higher premiums the older they are. And that's all we have time for. I'm not going to say we never look at it, but these things are relatively volatile, and we swap them often enough that we don't own them well enough for the actual. Like, I'm not saying there's not expensive funds out there, but. Well, it's in the asset value performance, and so we review that asset value performance on a 1 year, 6 month basis. So the cost of its investments come out of the asset value performance. So we know if someone charges 1%, he charges 2%, the 2% guy's meeting the 1% guy, you can consistently, and I'll let him, you know, so be it. I mean, we'll maintain our exposure to investments that are proving that they can grow relative to their peers. And there's very few closed-end funds with ridiculous expense ratios. And usually it's because of either private investments, international investments, leverage costs are included in that, which, again, if you get in that spread, it's still very beneficial to income and performance. But no, we're not really, you know, to me, the money's been made in the understanding of the nuanced differences than find a guy that's 25 basis points cheaper, because we're not an exposure-related firm. We're inefficient swapping income generation firm. So it's just, it's there, we track it, we have charts on it, but we don't really, it's never really been why I bought or sold anything.
So you don't necessarily recommend a long-term buy and hold strategy?
Well, so when we're at 9 discounts, then I think you're at, you know, upside longer term is less painful than when we're at 3 premiums. I think you're just putting yourself into more trouble that's worse. So part of it is your tax situation. Part of it is what sectors you're in. But when the volatility of the muni bond fund is the same roughly as the S&P 500, you know, and there's 100 to choose from, you're granted different credits, different duration, different managers, different sponsors, they're not all the same thing. There's, to me, opportunities to trade on the inefficiencies, because if you're buying these, you probably have bonds as part of why you're here. And I don't know many people who are really bond bulls right now, as in not the next 6 months, but the next 5-10 years. So if you're going to have bond exposure because you need it for credit reasons or for diversification, I think whether you trade it, I have a friend that trades 3% of his portfolio daily. He's at 120 million in closed-end funds, and I watched him trade. The friend, he doesn't even care about dividend coverage. And our firm is more balanced. We like manager performance, dividend sustainability, and then we worry about pricing. They're all very important, but we don't just buy one. We kind of try to blend the three. He just cares about one. He goes, I don't care. He goes, I'm not going to own it long enough to collect the dividends. Who cares? We may not, but when we buy a fund, we expect we'd be happy receiving the dividend until we see a reason to change. So there are people that own them for years and do fine, but I think there's some opportunity there in a group like this that generally is more analytical and has access to more information and more. You're probably going to enjoy trading them, if not daily, quarterly, monthly.
Well, wouldn't that make your tax-free investment taxable?
Only if you take gains.
Well, I mean, yeah. Okay, if you have a strategy that works, and you want to be able to get
the income, the dividend will stay tax-free.
Yes,
but if you can trade for alpha, then yeah, your clients will have to pay taxes on the gains you made them.
Do you report performance net of taxes, and you can add it to your account?
We don't, because we have such different clients and different in the same deposits that we taxes to us are just, they're just so. I don't know how to calculate that. You know, I can run an example, but really, if you're so tax sensitive, you're probably not. I mean, you're probably going to be buying whole closing fund because you just don't want to sell anything ever, or you're not going to be in the sector because you're worried about the other income.
So as a firm, though, do you report composite results?
Composite net fees. Yeah, composite net of our fees. Total average composite net returns for the month.
But it doesn't include the transaction costs?
It does. It's not include taxes. Because we love IRAs. We handle trust accounts fine, but we love IRAs.
Transaction costs associated with doing this. It's a little stock trading.
Yeah, I mean, it depends on your volume. It depends, that's completely how what your resources are. We are not a huge firm, so we pay $8 or $9 a share.
How much look-through do you have to the underlying holdings?
Different based on sectors, but some are very, very easy. But because, look-through, it's the quarterly reports. One reason why we really look like NAV performance, because every quarter managers aren't strangers to making their annual quarterly statements look the way they want them to. So. But between those two points, it's their actual net asset value performance, and you can judge that versus their peers, and you can look for.
So you don't get like with ETFs, you can see the daily holdings.
Yeah,
you can't do that with.
No, it's quarterly. Sometimes top tens are updated monthly. It's a very fund sponsor specific, but there you have net asset value performance as your guide to what's going on.
Do you get K-1s on the MLP fund?
Because they're 40X structures. I think there's one closed-end fund that gives a K-1. I believe it's CTF. It's a commodity fund. It's the only one. But if it's not that one, there's one that I know does, but none of the ones we own do. Return of capital trends, all I'll say is understand return of capital. It's a catch-all category. It can be because of a REIT or an MLP distribution. It can be a delayed transaction cost for a manager, or it can be we're going to pay a ridiculous yield. We didn't earn it. We didn't grow it, so we're going to give it to you, your money back. Enjoy. Generally avoid that. The destructive return of capital chart here, just again, it's not a perfect calculation, but it tells you the sectors where they currently are living. Equity funds have done much better on a one-year basis than bond funds, so bond funds are showing more destructive return of capital because the portfolio is not returning its NAV yield. But it requires return of capital to be part of the dividend. So if a bond fund is only paying income, it won't show up on this list. These are the biggest culprits by our data. Basically, dividend changes, the highlight here is over 5% increases, really large this quarter because capital, you know, there's a lot of end-of-year distributions. That's normally not 19%. It's normally closer to 7 to 9. Decreases the average cut over 5%. It's been 10%. So dividend cuts are part of being mindful of what you're in closed-end funds. They really can affect the portfolio. The biggest cuts in the last 6 months, the red bars here, are taxable bond funds. If we'd done this 6 months ago, it would have been the muni bond funds. But most of them, in our experience, based on the uni trend and based on the earnings coverages, most muni bond funds are actually earning the distribution or set for the next 6 months. And I know I'm close on time.
Classified into the taxable bond funds, is that? Emerging market debt.
Yes, yes. Any non-muni bond fund is a taxable grouping. It's the muni bond fund is much more homogenous of a group. Taxable bond funds definitely lots of convertibles. And, yeah, it's got a lot more different pieces. So people wonder why dividend cuts are bad, because if you own an open-end fund and they go from 5 cents a month to 4 cents, and then asset value performance doesn't change, let's pretend that's possible. There's no difference. You know, maybe a slight tax benefit to shareholders. However, if you own a closed-end fund at a big premium, at a big distribution yield, and they cut it like this one did 3 years ago and then again last year, but not as bad, you actually lost 35% on average on a 50% dividend cut on average, and that's the stock charts that follow. And that's not the manager doing badly. That's not the Wall Street Journal saying that the market's going to tank or Meredith Whitney doing anything on CNBC. It's just perceptional value. So you need to be cognizant of perceptional value in closed ends to be in them, because it drives their pricing. And generally speaking, deeper discounts protect you from that, because it's hard for a 10 discount to go to 12 without really good reason. It's easy for a 5 premium to go to a 2 premium for almost no reason. Fear and greed, this is, again, reinforces that 85% of owners are individual investors, that we don't just like discounts, don't just buy a discount, but that these are inefficient vehicles. If you're patient and diligent, if you do your homework, if you know what you're doing, better than most, and you should do well in the sector, because honestly, dividend cut happens, it usually, if a dividend cut happens on a Thursday, it typically takes till Monday for the market to react. Most people catch up on the week. So if the dividend cut happens on a Thursday, we get out typically Friday morning or on the open, and it usually very little market impact. If you wait till Monday, it's usually last fund we were in that we knew was an aggressive dividend, but we needed it for our model. We got out 3 cents above the VWAP for the day, which wasn't a bad move. The next day it was down 3%. Monday's open, it opened up down. And one of the biggest risks, and this actually, an advisor in Richmond come over and sit at my desk to kind of get the more personalized version of this talk. And he told me a closing fund he owned, a PIMCO fund at a big premium. He goes, but it's okay. It's at a 40 premium, but I bought it at a 20 premium and I've got to stop it at 30. So at least I'll make that 10% spread. I go, well, that makes one assumption. That assumes that the dividend announcement happens during the day and the market moves down not so crazy aggressive that it does price. If these people cut, they cut typically, the bad cuts happen Friday after the close, generally before a holiday weekend. They can time it. That's how Alpine did it last time. They did for MLK weekend last year. And you're going to open up percentage points lower than the close, so your stop will be tripped, but it won't be a 30 premium. You'll be hoping for a 20 premium. And I just hadn't thought of it that way. This has been a relatively good year for equity funds, but if you're in the closed-end marketplace and you want to beat the S&P 500, it can happen, but it's not your goal. These are more income-focused investments. They tend not to grow as aggressively unless they're in some very specific sectors. Like if you're in the Thai fund and it does awesome, yeah, you can make a ton of money. Or if you're in country funds or some sectors, like the healthcare funds this year, did phenomenal. But you can't expect to match the S&P 500 when you're a closed fund portfolio, even if you're in the equity, U.S. equity side, just because there's more stuff going on. People aren't just buying for growth. Closed-end funds are generally designed and sold and managed for distribution levels. They're not just capital appreciation vehicles, even though they give exposure to the capital appreciation of the market. And right now, when I look at the average muni bond fund off 16% this year, yeah, I mean, it could go lower, but there's a relative cheapness there if you need the credit quality, if you pick the duration that you're comfortable with, and a manager that doesn't do horrible work. Activist examples, all I can say is trending higher. IPOs, again, this slide will be available to you. We had 24 this year, 8 to 10 to me would be normal. I think it's a little high at 24, but we've averaged 28 funds a year in the last 10 years. And average size is just under $500 million. But we regularly get $1 billion funds. That's $2 to $3 billion funds are big in our sector. There's never been a year there wasn't a closed-end IPO. And if you want to know, these are the details of every IPO this year. In case you want to check it out, you'll have these slides. I knew we wouldn't have time to cover it, but I always give more information because I like information personally. As I said, there are 24 of the slides, normally not so long. This one, if you're interested in tax loss trading, this is closing fund IPOs from fourth quarter last year through second quarter this year. The IPO price, the current market price, the current discount, and the percent the market price is off its IPO. There's a couple here below 70, which means you're 30% or more off the IPO price. That tends to be a great place for people looking for tax loss harvesting. When those things bottom out, there's usually a nice pop in January. And this has some of the best culprits, again, based on the most people bought. All these were the shares were bought within the last 12 months, except for a few in the fourth quarter. And so there's a great short-term tax loss harvesting available that happens every year. And the worst 200 performing close-end funds right now are showing a relative discount versus themselves of a percent wider than the middle 200 funds. And a percent and a half wider than the best 200 funds. And I did that data. Actually, that's both 2012 data and 13. Very different years. Bond funds did awesome last year, got clean this year, and yet the data was very close with the best 200 and the worst 200 comparing them. Because of 600 funds, it's easy to bucket it that way and to try to take out sector risk and fund sponsor risk and things of that nature. Not a perfect scenario, but one that we looked at. Mergers, big, because there's a lot of similar funds, a lot of state bond funds merged. It will settle down eventually. All I can say, deaths, people think closed-end funds are being killed by ETFs. They're different. They go after different markets. They go after different personalities, different investment objectives. Deaths have actually been trending down since 07. Only three, and we've had only five a year on average in the last 3 years. This is, you know, you have your own philosophy. This is usually for a retail group. But IPO, I can't say you won't make money on the IPO, but our research looked at 50 closed-end funds with trackable ETFs, and we looked at what rough time period was the best entry point after for like a two-year performance that beat the ETF. It's 7 to 11 months, with actually 9 being the closest integer, which is 9 months. If you wait for 9 months, it's generally an 8% alpha versus the IPO price. Again, there's always exceptions to every rule, but it's why we've never bought on the IPO, and very few people do. Somebody has to.
How did they ever get sold?
Yeah. 85% owned by retail, and we did talk to the syndicate desk actively. They're working on a way to bring out closed-end funds with less load on the front, and a way to still create them because they have to be sold. Because they're born as a billion-dollar fund, you know, they got to be raised. You got to pay someone to raise that, and I don't think they're buy and hold forever. This is the way I trade them. I don't trade them as actively as some. I don't trade them as lightly as some.
Who are the primary buyers of your research?
Generally, advisors that used to have a closed fund analyst and missed them. They only buy the best ideas list. People that like to have data, spreadsheets, which buy our weekly data. Anyone that generally owns closed funds, our new system is so cheap. Like, honestly, I priced it last summer because I was at a conference. I built it for me. How do you know if a dividend change happens? Oh, I have this analyst that he knows me every morning. And she goes, well, how much can I buy that for you? I don't know, $100? So we priced it at $2 a week, and she bought it that day. And then we started to mention it was available on our website. So. To me, it's an organized news system. If you have, it's organized, so it's really nothing special. It's the least special thing that we do. But so it's generally people with over 25 million in closed funds institutionally. Individuals usually, the buyer service generally have over 2 million in closed funds to justify the consulting and research costs.
So it's small institutional firms and mainly private investors.
Private investors, yeah, over 2 million in closed ends, and then the smaller firms, generally under 100 million in firm assets, though we have
numbers of people that buy it.
Our best ideas list just launched last month. We're limiting that to 50 people because when we designed it over the summer, because of advisors saying we need something, they said two things: it needs to be good, so we're going to be tracking it versus peer group averages. And then I hope it's good. I do my best. The second is, if too many people have it, it's not worthwhile. So we said, you know what? This is a product. I know that 1,000 people are never going to buy it. Let's just cap it. That way, we never have to worry or have less worry about research. And like different brokerage firms, some have asked for it, and, and,
and we won't let their analysts have it. Like, we only let an individual advisor have it. We don't want it if any more consulting, we're just more focused, specific, we do that. But I want to give them that list because they're gonna push the prices around too much. That's my perception. Outlook, again, basically, bond funds are relatively cheap. Equity, I think, has some run in it. We think this dividends should be sustainable. You should be mindful where activists can come in. I know I'm keeping you over. News information is important. This is the last real slide. But remember, it's not just yield. It's the actual total return. These things are relatively diversified. They're not one common stock. They're a portfolio manager doing something. He has to be decent. There's leverage of the fund itself, leverage of the discount. You can trade them as you choose, on your own through the day. There's no redemption pressures, which means you generally avoid buy high, sell low mentality, like the open-end structure, though it's not perfect. Discounts can go crazy for no reason on either direction. And I think there's a ton of inefficiency because it's not a lot of billion-dollar shops. These are free resources, some of the best I've found in my career. And then non-associated with our company. So it's not like I'm saying this is all of our stuff. No, it's our stuff is on this slide. So, now these are our models from the inception date. These are our bios in case you didn't hear it. These are links to stuff that are our information. That's it.
Any funds blow up in
08? So do they blow up as in people
like
permanently lost money? Couple of funds
didn't work. They were
the leverage of especially the muni side of the market, which was really big in preferreds, had to get very creative to maintain the tax beneficial nature of the distributions. A couple of funds hit those thresholds. Who was it? I can't remember which fund it was, but at a conference, the guy says your fund didn't pay its November dividend, and the manager goes, yeah, we did. I'm curious about that. I looked into it. Well, they did, but they paid it in December. They paid two in December, and they missed November because they weren't allowed to, because when you're over your leverage requirements, you're not allowed to pay a distribution. So investors got their yield by year end. What companies have done, funds have done, is they've added revolvers. And so they've kept permanent leverage where they can and where it makes sense. But they've added revolvers that can be scaled up and down very easily, so that they can avoid that risk. There was a point in November of 2008, if you bought the average muni bond fund, you're paying 70 cents on the dollar because it was that crazy of a time. But if you didn't panic and sell and sit and wait, it returned very well. The funds that if you sat and held on to that did poorly were the ridiculously yielding equity funds that had to keep cutting their dividends because they had just ridiculous yields that weren't maintainable. And so some of those charts are just not pretty. Those are the only sectors that really got clobbered on a total return basis.
And you mentioned earlier that inflation is 3, but there's an improvement of 2.
Well, so this just read this on the plane last night, so I'm still digesting it. But the concept is, so Apple comes out with an iPad every year, and they price it the same as last year's iPad, but it's a better iPad. So the Bureau of Labor Statistics actually discounts inflation because you're getting a better iPad for $500. So if you think about what we have access to, what we consider to be required to have a standard of living better than our peer average, that's the baseline that Americans shoot for. As everyone has fast internet connections at home, then just spending $50 a month on the internet at home becomes a normal cost. When I was in college, I think you paid like $9 to AOL. I mean, it was much, much faster. And it's interesting, at the same time that he compared airline travel. So if anyone traveled a lot for work 10 years ago versus today, I didn't travel a lot 10 years ago, but seats have gotten smaller. There's no meals. You pay for better. You would say this, argue that you actually have a worse experience on average unless you're a premium flyer on a plane 10 years ago versus today, and yet that doesn't reduce, that doesn't get added back into, that doesn't reduce the value of that in the statistics. This basically, the concept is this. If you want to have today's standard of living 20 years from now, not taking advantage of the improvements in quality of life, then that's closer to 3% a year. If you want to go up with that, it's about 1% to 2% a year, depends on how things are trending and your personal taste, to be able to beat, to get the new normal standard of living that we want as Americans. And it was an idea I'd never heard before.
I thought it was reversed. It's like a plasma TV has gone from 8,000 to 2,000.
But how often do you buy a plasma TV? Versus, yeah. So there. So that was mentioned as one of the, you know, generally not every you know, as often as you buy things that have been trending higher. So the thought is the government, and this is not why I came today, but is the government, you know, saying inflation's low because it helps their cost of finance? Not really. Just they analyze what they can, and what they're statisticians, and it's just a known limit in any data. Our data has limits. I mean, there's a reason we have more than one data point, because there's no perfect data point. I mean, we have 125 right now, and we had 67 a year ago because we're still trying to cut into ways of finding a better way to do it based on what we want that day. But that, again, his book is Bonds Aren't Forever. It's a second book. He's a rather sharp guy. His first book is well rated as well. Leverage costs vary. But having leverage costs being just under 1% to slightly over is not abnormal. I mean, we're right now, because the leverage cost is not very transparent, my data team is currently, like, we just added the types of leverage 2 weeks ago to our data, and right now they're going through, and calculating leverage cost is hard, because when it's done as a swap, when do you recognize the cost? So we're trying to struggle. If it's a preferred stock, or if it's a credit line, if it's a variable or fixed rate, very easy to blend out the average cost of leverage. So we're still figuring that out. But leverage costs are still very, very favorable. Senior loan funds are fascinating because of the probable, you know, little impact to rising rates. The issue is in the shortest term for senior loan funds, you've got a lot of LIBOR floors to where as rates pop up, it's actually going to hurt short-term net investment income until the LIBOR floors are met. And then when rates keep going up, they'll be great. So that's why I think senior loan funds are showing discounts where they are now, because a lot of people recognize this short-term challenge in net investment income being squeezed. But right now, these funds, their job is to get good cost of leverage. They're usually big enough shops that they can get good numbers. But I'll have better data within 2 weeks, I hope, if my data team solves all my problems.
Listen, the big issue back in 08 and 03 was the fact that they had a short-term rates jump 50 basis points or more. At the same time, long rates jumped 50 basis points or more. It was a two-edged sword. Rate was coming down. Yields were going up.
It is, and that's where, I mean, we've had two credit events in like 20 years, and one more sooner than the other. Boards and funds, they've seen, I mean, I think they were tested to the limits in 08. And so they've learned what happens on that side of the equation. They've seen rising rates. Everyone, I think, in the equivalent world believes rates will rise, just they don't know when. So they're planning for that, because they need net investment income to be better than their peers to be competitive, to avoid discounts. So there's a self-sustaining, must be my friend. I know that they're pulling the hook on me.
Let's give John a round of applause. Feel free to, if you have any more questions,
I'll stick for about an hour, and then I've got another meeting. But no one's here, that's fine. I'll just call the office, check the markets.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks a lot.
No problem.
Appreciate it. A lot of questions.
Yeah, a lot of good questions. I've got to cut it down to fact. It was 40 slides a year and a half ago, and it just kept running.
No, it was great.
I've got